It's here and now. Two rulings today from the Supreme Court. In the first ruling, the court gave police officers protection from lawsuits that result from high-speed car chases. In the second, the court refused to hear the case of two Guantanamo Bay prisoners hoping to challenge the legality of military commissions. Salid Ahmed Hamdan and Omar Khadr face commission trials. Hamdan accused of acting as a driver and bodyguard for Osama bin Laden, and Khadr of throwing a grenade that killed a U.S. Green Beret soldier. Lyle Denniston covers the Supreme Court for SCOTUS blog. He joins us now. Lyle, briefly remind us what this case is about.
This case was mainly about trying to get an opportunity for these two detainees in Guantanamo to go back into court to challenge the war crimes tribunals that they face in coming weeks. The lower court threw out their case because Congress had taken away the jurisdiction to hear such cases, and these two gentlemen argued that that was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court simply refused to hear their case, which means that their fate now goes back to the lower courts and then ultimately to the military trials.
Right. And as you said, the lower courts have already ruled.
They've already ruled that they cannot bring a broad challenge. They can only bring a very limited kind of challenge to the military commission after they are convicted. In other words, they can't stop the trial from going forward.
But they can have an appeal?
They can have an appeal, but it probably would be more limited than the one that they were trying to get before Congress undercut their what's called habeas corpus rights.
Right. So what's the overall significance of the ruling today to you?
To me, it means, Robin, primarily that the Supreme Court, after being very directly and centrally involved in monitoring what was happening to the detainees, has decided, at least for the time being, to go to the sidelines and to let it play out in the lower courts under legal circumstances that are really not very favorable to the detainees. And I don't know that this represents a change simply because there are new members of the court. I think probably what it means is that Justice Anthony Kennedy has sort of gotten cold feet about continuing to hear cases involving Guantanamo detainees and wants to take a breather for a while.
Well, tell us more about that, because our understanding is that the last time Mr. Hamdan in particular brought his appeal, you know, his claim that the military commission was illegal, the court ruled in favor of Hamdan, declaring President Bush's system of military commission trials violating U.S. and international law.
I think probably when you look at most of these cases, Justice Kennedy has become really the decider here, because he's got the controlling middle vote between two factions on the court, and he is the one who had supplied the fifth vote the last time in Mr. Yeah. Hamdan's favor, and now he's decided that he doesn't want the court to be involved for the time being.
We also understand that subsequently, since that last appeal to the Supreme Court by Mr. Hamdan, the then Republican Congress pushed through a law sort of reconstituting military commissions, giving them the congressional approval they didn't previously had. Prior to that, they just had executive order.
The detainees and their lawyers contend that these new tribunals, even though the Congress has blessed them with new legislation, are imperfect too, and they were trying to claim that their constitutional rights to be treated fairly in a legal process will be scuttled by these new tribunals. But they are now going to have to go through the trials and can appeal only if they are convicted. So there's no way to, at this point, to stop the trials from occurring.
Right. So this is a defeat for the Guantanamo detainees and their lawyers and backers, and a win for the Bush administration.
Very much a victory for the Bush administration, because it has been fighting very aggressively against all of these claims by detainees, insisting that they have no legal rights whatsoever. It had lost three cases in the Supreme Court. Now it appears with this order today and one denying two other cases on April 2nd that the administration is on a run of victory.
Lyle Denniston covers the Supreme Court for SCOTUS blog and is catching us up on today's Supreme Court decisions. Lyle, thanks so much.
All right, you're most welcome.
Well, today we want to have a conversation about memory loss. Of course, it's always happened. The ancient Greeks wore rosemary wreaths on their head to improve their memory. But today's baby boomers may be grappling with something a little different. They're working decades longer than their parents did, with more information thrown at them. And they may also be having a delayed reaction to bumps on the head from bike rides or football tackles made decades ago. Catherine Jacobson-Raymond was a hard-hitting journalist whose memory began slipping when she hit her 40s. She discovered others experiencing the same thing, not just losing keys, but calling high-level meetings and then forgetting why. Her own memory loss, as she tried to raise two little boys with her husband and continue her work, was so anxiety-provoking that she turned herself into a human guinea pig, embarking on a 3-year journey that took her to sleep clinics, neuropsychologists, dementia, head injury, thyroid and menopause experts, nutritionists, even salsa dancing. Author Catherine Jacobson-Raymond's resulting book is entitled Carved in Sand: When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. She told us that she found a lot of shame and secrecy about memory loss as baby boomers try to hold on to their jobs.
I actually did. I've been a journalist for many, many years, and I've interviewed people on basically every subject, including infidelity. And I've never seen so many people need to be anonymous as I saw when we were talking about memory.
You wrote up a 10-page questionnaire survey that you sent out, and it started to exponentially spread around the world, you know, people sending it to other people. What were some of the things, quickly, that people said about memory loss?
People had lots of things to say. Often they talked about how tricky it was to be middle-aged in a work environment where people were generally much younger. Mm-hmm. There's a physiological basis for what's happening here. It's not something that you're imagining. As you enter your late 20s, your processing speed begins to slow down. And you typically do not notice this in your 30s because you have sufficient cognitive reserve, enough spare neurons, as it were, to get you through. Now, as you enter your 40s, that number of neurons begins to dwindle just a little bit, and a lot of times people really start to feel it.
As you point out, in your 50s and 40s, you're also grappling with little kids, which previously those kids would have been grown up. You'd have a lot less to remember.
Well, I always say that menopause and adolescence should never meet, but they do all the time now.
So. You compare this to 1876, when Graham Bell invented the phone, and there were suddenly all sorts of new illnesses, railway neurosis, elevator sickness. People were rattled by that. As you write, they are rattled now by this onslaught of technology information. So to get to the bottom of your memory problems, you undertook 10 interventions. It was just amazing to go with you. As we said, you made yourself this sort of guinea pig, went for a full evaluation for Alzheimer's, went for full nutritional workups, went to sleep clinics, underwent neurofeedback to manipulate your brain waves. You had little shocks in your head, took part in mindful meditation, got a full neuropsychological evaluation, went on the drugs Adderall and Provigil.
Correct.
Yep. You got a diagnosis. But along the way, what did you find out?
Well, I found out that memory is actually not what we're dealing with in middle age. We are dealing with issues of attention, distraction, concentration, and focus. Now, we like to lump all of these under this general term, memory loss. It's actually inaccurate. When we're talking about memory loss, what we're talking about, if someone hands you a multiple choice vocabulary test, and on it are words you've known all your life, and now you don't know some of them, that would be memory loss. That would be very serious. That would be pathological. Mm. That is not what we are dealing with in middle age, typically. In middle age, what we're dealing with is what one scientist called a neural bouncer who has gone on a coffee break. Now, get the image, the neural bouncer, just like the bouncer out in front of a nightclub with a velvet rope. When you're younger, that bouncer is in position and things are not going in that should not be going in. As you get older, the neural bouncer goes off on these coffee breaks and suddenly all sorts of riffraff makes it past the rope. So there's constant background noise infiltrates.
Is this what you found was called attention deficit trait, not ADHD? but attention deficit trait, ADT.
Well, attention deficit trait is not my term. It's actually Edward Hallowell's term, and he is a psychiatrist over in Sudbury.
Here in Massachusetts,
who is a specialist in ADHD and certainly one of the foremost in the world. And I went to talk to him after I read a piece that he'd written for the Harvard Business Review, where he described this phenomenon of having suddenly flood tides of adults, many of them middle-aged, coming to his office saying, "Doctor, I think I've developed ADD. And he thought...
Attention deficit disorder.
Exactly. Yeah. He thought to himself, well, how could this be possible? I mean, these people were fine as children. So he started to look at this very closely. And what he realized was that this was purely environmental. If you pluck these people out of a situation where they were being bombarded and pounded to death with information and interruption and plop them down by a nice calm lake someplace, all these problems went away. It wasn't in them. It was from outside them.
Yeah. Oh, let's tick through some of the other things you discovered. You had the UCLA Memory Clinic brain scan. What did you learn there?
Well, I had a PET scan and I had an MRI. I had a full blood workup. I had a brief neuropsychological exam and a bunch of other things as well.
But you found out you were starving your brain and you needed to eat more protein in the morning.
I needed to get more glucose delivered on a more regular basis to my brain. The brain runs on glucose. Glucose is the brain's only fuel. And if you do not get it to the brain will quit working. And you will find yourself in the slows and lows and feel really, really dumb, and you won't know why.
Hmm. Again, moving through what you learned, the nature-nurture argument. There's a study that showed that rats who were better coddled and cared for by their mothers had less memory problems?
Yes, in middle age. Isn't that something?
Something, yeah.
It really is. Well, this particular study, which was done by Tally Barham, showed that when mother rats were deprived of sufficient bedding for their young, they found that stressful. And although the infants were generally resembled all other rat infants, by the time they got to middle age, they had memory problems. They had cognitive issues, and they were not able to find their way through mazes nearly as well. So if you're having trouble getting through the airport, that could be part of the reason.
It's amazing stuff. And some of the things you rejected, you said this isn't for me, you know, for your issue. But some you realized could be. For instance, you learned that concussions as a kid can affect us in middle age. Concussions we didn't even really think about.
That's right. Well, no one does. You know, you take a fall off a bike as a kid, and if you socked your chin, your brain went rocketing back into your head and behaved like a super ball. And it's very, very possible that you had a mild concussion. You certainly don't need to be unconscious to have had one. One concussion is not great, but successive concussions in short order, weeks or months apart, can be very, very damaging, whether they occur in childhood or in adulthood. And as athletes, this can be a problem.
That's Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, author of Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. We'll hear more about those bumps to the head, but quick reminder, also later today, the history of the Mormons, the American religion in the spotlight as Mitt Romney seeks the White House and PBS focuses two programs on that faith. That's later today. But we'll be back after a very quick break. What were we talking about? Oh, yes, memory loss. Here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more of our conversation with Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, author of the book Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. Jacobson-Raymond made herself a test subject and underwent a battery of tests. She tried meditation, prescription drugs, all in an effort to boost her failing memory as she hit her 40s. And she discovered that perhaps a fall from a horse might have had an impact. One doctor who was assessing her sports-related head injuries when she was a child said that Jacobson-Raymond was now like two people, one impressively competent, the other incredibly deficient.
Kind of insulting. Well, it was a little hard to take.
Yeah.
But he said it, and I had to deal with it.
Well, and that it's almost like that's the worst place to be in.
Because no, he said it was the best place because he said if I was only the person who was deficient, it would be all over for me. Hmm. He said that the fact that in some tests I was impressively competent meant that I could find a way to make up for the parts that weren't working. Right. And that's what I spent 3 years figuring out.
Right. Well, continuing along the trail with you, when I came to the chapter on drugs, I thought, well, now this is interesting, especially some drugs that are used for memory enhancement in Europe that aren't legal here. But as you started to take them and you started to feel better, there were points where you felt better. I thought, what's next? And what was next that you decided that maybe there was a trade-off you weren't willing to have of your physical health?
Well, you know, I was given a prescription for Adderall, mm-hmm. which is actually a drug that is commonly used to treat the results of mild traumatic head injury and is often very successful in treating it. And I found while taking Adderall that there were great improvements. My word recall changed dramatically. I was much better able to navigate in places that I had been before. Things were just better in terms of work, but they were much, much worse in terms of the rest of my life. I simply did not have the personality that I started with.
Right.
And I found that I was just turned into a workaholic and I didn't have a life. Yeah. And during this period, I realized that there was another drug, and it was called Provigil, and it was being studied both in the UK and very, very heavily, I might add, by the U.S. military. And Provigil was a drug that was originally designed to help narcoleptics, people who fall asleep suddenly. And eventually that labeling was extended to daytime sleepiness and other factors. But what it really, really does is enhance attention. Mm-hmm. And I had done a lot of research on it. I presented that to a neurologist that I was seeing. And he eventually, long after I was off of Adderall completely, gave me a prescription for it. And I found that it was very, very helpful.
Well, I want to touch on two things before we get to your final diagnoses, because, of course, you can't do this without talking about Alzheimer's and menopause. And you find all sorts of interesting things about Alzheimer's, including that it actually begins earlier than we think. There's seeds of it that
yes.
are sown earlier and
yes.
visible earlier in midlife, and people need to push doctors to ask about that.
Yeah, it's a really scary thing to have to do, but new research shows that this disease is not a disease of old age. This is a disease where the seeds are planted in midlife. Mm-hmm. And now scientists
can you offset it? Can you offset
it? You sure can. You certainly can. Now, you know, not everyone is going to be able to, but there are how you live your life, how you take care of your body, how you take care of your mind, whether you feed yourself properly, whether you get the right amount of aerobic exercise, which is turning out to be very, very important. Depression is not a good thing. And depression leads to Alzheimer's in very high numbers. But also the idea of maintaining a mental challenge. Now, this is harder than you'd think, actually. We say, oh, we go to work, we go home, we do the second shift, we're so busy, we have our philanthropy, we have our community work, it's just, you know, who has time? But the fact is that in order to build new neural pathways and keep synaptic connections really lively, what you need to do is have that mental challenge, which means doing something different than what you do all the time.
To menopause, it was interesting to read that a lot of people attribute the memory loss to the disappearance of estrogen, but as you write, the lack of estrogen only affects, was it verbal memory?
Well, this is very controversial, mm-hmm. first of all. And the studies show that, several studies show that the faculty primarily affected is verbal. So you will find that there's more word loss, etc. Now, people tend to attribute absolutely everything to the loss of estrogen. And one thing is that women often tell me that they know the reason for all of these cognitive problems is menopause. They're wrong. Mm-hmm. It actually happens that menopause occurs, you know, around 50, you know, in your early 50s, which is a time that men and women experience these cognitive changes.
Well, eventually, you were diagnosed with hypothyroidism. It took 8 years to get to this correct diagnosis. Can you just briefly tell us, what was it, and how did it affect your memory?
Well, early in my 40s, I noticed that several things were happening, and this was concurrent with my memory, with the changes in my memory. I had moved from Southern California to Northern California and started a new job and moved into a new house on the same day I started the new job, and I had two little kids, and I had lost a lot of weight, and my hair was falling out, and things were not looking good. And I went to an endocrinologist, and I said, hey, look at me. And she said, well, you know, it looks like a thyroid disorder. And then she ordered the tests, and after the test, she said, well, tests don't say that. You don't have a thyroid disorder. I guess you're fine, and you can go away now. Try to eat. Now, it's a little complicated, but there's a great debate raging about where appropriate thyroid levels should be set, and that if we looked closely and accurately, tons and tons and tons of people have subclinical thyroid disorders, which may result from there being so little iodine in our water supply now. That has been more or less removed.
And just again, if people have just tuned in and thought, oh, what the heck, so every now and then you lose your keys. It's not that.
It's very painful. It destroys self-confidence. It hurts self-esteem. It's hard to recover. And I know that I heard from hundreds and hundreds of midlife people that it is really something that bothers them. And, you know, given the interest in the book, I have to think that they were right. It is generally a serious question for people.
Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, author of the book Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here Now, President Bush expected to make only a second veto. Still ahead today, Mormons in America. It's Here and Now.
Support for Here.
Here and Now. With Mormon Mitt Romney running for president, more Americans than ever are interested in learning about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They may vaguely know that it began in the early 1800s in upstate New York when young Joseph Smith claimed that Christ appeared and told him to denounce all existing churches. Smith then said future visions led him to the ancient gold plates that told the story of the Israelites who sailed from Jerusalem to America. But what happened then? Why are Mormons genealogists? Why are non-Mormons not allowed in temples? Why are Mormon children sent on two-year missions? Why are we asking why? This week, public television tries to answer those questions in a two-part special, The Mormons. It's scheduled to air tonight and tomorrow on PBS stations around the country. And filmmaker Helen Whitney joins us in the studio with more. Helen, give us first your overarching thought about Mormons in America.
Well, it's a dynamic religion, one of the fastest-growing religions, certainly American religions, and it's on its way to becoming a world religion. I think that what's not generally known is that at least half of its 12 million members live outside the country.
But it is an American
religion. It is a quintessentially American religion, and in a very interesting way that it takes some very American qualities and takes them a step further. I mean, when you think of America, so many people think of its boundless optimism, the American dream. You can become wealthy and important. You can even become president. The Mormons say all of that's true, but you can even take it to a greater degree. If you lead a just life, one can become godlike in the hereafter. Another very American idea is that Gatsby-like reinventiveness.
Right.
Well, the Mormons reinvented themselves to some extent in the 20th century. It's an extraordinary, not well-known story of a religion on the edge of extinction, reviled outsiders as they were perceived, and today, within 100 years, almost mainstream. And finally, the last one is this exceptional America's sort of sense of being an exceptional country, this sort of city on the hill, the shining city on the hill. The Mormons say not only that, not only do we have a special destiny, all history began here.
Well, let's pick up where, as you said, this was a faith almost on the brink of extinction. The Mormons, your film indicates, invited persecution in the beginning because when they moved into towns, they demanded complete control. The governor of Missouri at one point said that Mormons had to be driven from the state, and they then settled in Nauvoo, Illinois. This is where Joseph Smith had two more visions that play such a key role in the faith: baptism of the dead and celestial marriage or polygamy. Tell us more about those.
Mm-hmm. Joseph Smith claimed to have had a revelation that God commanded him and others to live polygamy, and that polygamy was essential to salvation, to living in the top tier of the afterlife. And it was as important to 19th century polygamists as baptism is to the Christian.
And baptism of the dead to the Mormons. Why?
Baptism for the dead answers the question for the Mormons that virtually all religions ask, which is, well, if we believe we have the one true faith, what happens to everybody who's died and never heard of Christ or whomever you're... most religions say, well, I guess that's too bad. You've died. The Mormons say there's a second chance. And when you die, when all of us die, we go to the, according to Mormonism, we go to a spirit world. And in that world, as the Mormons believe, you can be missionized. If you have an ordinance done on earth, which is someone performing this rite for that dead person, a missionary in the afterlife can approach that dead person and say, here's Mormonism. Let me describe it to you. Would you like to convert? But it can't be done unless there is a rite done for that person on earth.
And we want to rush to say that both of these practices, baptism of the dead and polygamy, well, polygamy has been renounced by the church.
Completely. For the last 100 years, if you become polygamous, you are excommunicated instantly.
And there was an uproar over the baptism of the dead. It came from Holocaust survivors like Roman Kent of the American Gathering of Holocaust Survivors. Let's listen.
6 million my brothers and my friends and my family were killed because they were Jews. So I wanted them to be Jews. I wanted them to remain Jews. And I didn't want anybody later on, 100, 200 years from now, to tell me that my parents were not Jewish because somewhere in the archives in the Mormon church, there is my father's name, my mother's name is listed as a Gentile, as a Mormon person.
The LDS Church has reached a total accommodation with these Jewish groups who protested. Only if a Jewish relative who's converted to Mormonism brings names of their relatives will they do it.
I want to go back to the chronology of Mormonism. As you tell it, Joseph Smith is killed by an angry mob. Leadership of the Mormons shifts to Brigham Young. He brings the Mormons out of Illinois to the Valley of the Great Salt Lake in Utah, and a huge migration. Moving into the 19th century, the Mormons start to achieve respectability. It took 4 years, but Reed Smoot becomes the first Mormon senator. The hearings were as intense as Watergate. As Mormons become mainstream, people become aware of their organizational skills, most recently in New Orleans. They sent trucks of supplies before relief agencies. Because why? I mean, you show a huge granary that stands today in Salt Lake, 16 million pounds of wheat, that are to be used only in the tumult before Christ's return. Is this what Mormons' organizational skills are about, you know, preparing for the rapture?
I would say the roots of that go much farther back. This was a people that had to move quickly at the jump ahead of the people who were persecuting them for a long while. And Brigham Young developed extraordinary organizational skills, as did a lot of other people, for survival reasons. You know, we must take care of our own. And the Mormons are famously organized. And the way that the church is organized is in small wards, and there's a bishop that runs each ward, and they really know what's going on. So when something happens, either to their own or, let's say, in Katrina, it's basically just a few phone calls have to be made, and you have thousands of volunteers.
Mm-hmm. And the same organizational skills are applied to the missionary work. Mm-hmm. Young people are required to do 2 years. It's a very intense missionary program. They are with a partner. What's it called? A
companion.
A companion. 24 hours a day together. They're never a private time. And why is that? What is the proselytizing part of the faith?
The missionary program is really, to a large extent, the engine that drives this church, and it always has. I mean, it's intense, it's focused, and even though they meet a lot of rejection, this is the church's way not only of reaching out and becoming or starting to become a worldwide religion, it's also a way of proselytizing their own. If you as a young man or woman go through this intense 2 years, primarily of rejection, certainly in certain countries, you might make two conversions the entire 2 years. In the process, you either strengthen your faith, which is most of the time what happens, or you lose it.
Let's listen to a scene in which a couple of young men are trying to do just that, proselytize. It doesn't go very well. I believe they're in New York City.
And we're out here talking to people because we're sharing a great message about Jesus Christ during this time of Christmas.
She told me to leave her alone.
Hi.
Oh, no.
How you doing today, sir?
Kind of busy.
Oh, aren't we all? Yeah. Where are you headed?
We're missionaries.
Don't shadow me. Don't walk next to me. I said I'm busy. Please.
Sounds of young Mormons proselytizing in filmmaker Helen Whitney's special, The Mormons, a joint production of Frontline and the American Experience that airs tonight and tomorrow on PBS stations. You're listening to Here and Now. Helen Whitney, you also have video that I don't think I've ever seen this before, video taken inside a Mormon temple. These are not the wards, sort of the churches that are in neighborhoods. These are the huge temples. Outsiders are not allowed in, except for the few days before it's dedicated. And by the way, we'll have a link on our website to the story we did when we were allowed with our audio inside a temple here in Massachusetts. This is where there are a lot of questions that arise about the faith, because you talk to Mormons who say, yes, when we go in the temple, we learn hand signals so that when we die, we know how to find God. We learn passwords so we know how to find God. We do a signal of drawing a finger across our neck to demonstrate that we will never speak of what happens in here. That's where, for some people, I mean, every faith has its mysteries and its rituals we don't understand, but that's where, for some people, it begins to sound cultish. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that it's a church that, as it runs a candidate for president, is going to be able to make that next move into being a more public, mainstream body?
I actually do, and I think they're sort of, in many ways, there already, but there's a lag in public perception about them. And if one thing I have been stunned by was how little is known and how much misinformation is out there. I mean, truly stunned.
Well, for instance, you asked the question, will Mitt Romney have to take orders from the leader of the church? It's a question a lot of people have.
And they asked it of John F. Kennedy as well, and they asked it of Reed Smoot 100 years ago. They held up his confirmation hearings 4 years precisely because of that question, which was answered 100 years ago, and he went on to become one of the most powerful senators.
But as you point out in the film, the church doesn't brook any dissent.
You know, it's a wonderful church if you do fit in. And as one of the church elders said in the film, he said, we're very tough, and we do have a standard of obedience in the sense of, chasteness before marriage. That's the primary one. And the centrality of families, and there's a word of wisdom about alcohol and coffee, and that's very important. But in terms of telling people what to think, that's not the case. The church gets into the crosshairs of intellectuals if they go down certain areas and ask certain questions about the core foundational truths of the church.
And of women, I want to jump in to say, women, you made the point, or people, your subjects make the point that Mormonism can have an extra pressure for women because if you blow it, I think is what someone said, if you question, if you are excommunicated, you risk your child's eternal salvation.
Well, because for Mormons, salvation comes collectively, not individually. It's the family that's central. So you are together sort of, moving into the afterlife and the infractions of one weigh in on the group itself. It's quite unusual that way.
When you talk about the importance of the family, there is quite a moment where you meet a family and a young girl who has an illness. She may not have a long lifespan.
Yes.
And she speaks to you about, but the comfort is she knows and that she will meet her family again and have eternal life with them.
It was astonishing to sort of live with that family and see it happen. And it really is where the rubber hits the road. We all talk about our hope, or many of us do, about something that lies beyond. But the afterlife for the Mormons is amazingly concrete and specific. It's not that she doesn't want to die. She wants to get married and have children and have a boyfriend, and the family is grieving with her, but they are not distraught and fearful. And she's living her life out. Now, she's an aspiring opera singer. She's an amazing singer, with sort of joy and humor and passion still. She's not crippled with fear and anxiety. It's quite stunning, actually.
Right. And comforting, her.
That certainty of it. I mean, she really viscerally, as well as intellectually, believes this, that she will be reunited with her family.
Every atom of flesh, as someone says.
Yeah.
filmmaker Helen Whitney. Her film is The Mormons. There is so much more, but we'll just guide you to the program itself. It's a joint Frontline and American Experience production scheduled to air on PBS stations around the country. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Helen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, still ahead, evangelical balloons and other stories of balloon twisters here and now. It's Here and Now, and it's time to name that sound. That, of course, is a tube of inflated latex, although you know it as a balloon, being twisted and turned into the likeness of a dog, because you know what they say.
Once you know how to make a balloon dog, you can do anything.
That's Vera, one of a cast of real-life characters in a new film that follows a community of balloon twisters over the course of a few years across the country and to their annual convention called Twist and Shout. Who knew there was such a thing, or that it could be so compelling? Here with us is Naomi Greenfield, who, along with her colleague Sarah Taskler, made Twisted, a balloonamentary. Welcome, Naomi.
Thank you.
Oh, what an amazing cast of characters you found. There's Vera, a trailer park teenager who got off welfare and got through college by twisting balloons. John, a former felon who found salvation by blowing what he calls the breath of God into balloons. He's part of a subset of balloon twisters called gospel balloons. You contrast them in your film with the people who make adult balloons. How did you get pulled into this world?
I just kind of on a whim heard about these conventions, and I figured I would just check it out because it just was the weirdest thing I'd ever heard of. And I just was so awestruck by, first, the visual take of what all the sculptures were when I walked into the hotel.
Well, at these annual conventions, which attract hundreds of balloon makers from all over the world, they have classes, they have competitions, they have something called the Jam Room, where people just go and compulsively make balloon things, a huge Trojan horse, a giant remote-controlled shark, 100-foot-tall soccer players, and these 5-foot-long racing cars. They make them and then they put them over themselves like the Jetsons and drive them through the hotel like little kids. Let's listen.
Okay, take the cars down.
Started racing around the convention center. Absolutely mayhem.
Naomi, this is one of the happiest groups of people I've ever seen.
That was the sense I got from everyone that was there. And then people had really interesting backstories, some of which were not so happy. And
right.
And I was kind of captivated by the idea that they come for a weekend to a place where it really is all happy, and maybe they forget some of the troubles from home.
Right.
Or in a lot of the cases of the people in the film, balloons brought them from a place that was more difficult to a place that was really much better in their lives.
Well, in fact, let's meet some of those people. John Balloon Man Holmes, for instance, from Cedar Hill, Texas, a former felon, a recovering addict, found God, and he practices what we refer to as gospel ballooning. Let's listen to a little of John.
I do a Jesus on the cross balloon with nails in the hands, crown of thorns, like he's just said, it is finished, slumped over and gave up the ghost. I actually made it with the balloon equipped and circumcised like a good little Jewish boy should be. Every time I make Jesus on the cross, I'm coming to tears talking about it. Every time I make it, I go, I get to make that? I get to do that. I get to do balloons. I don't gotta do them, I get to do them. The big question is though, what is it that you're doing with the breath of life that God gave you?
At another point in the film, John says, if it weren't for a shiny tube of tree sap, known as a balloon, of course, latex comes from tree sap, we're reminded in your film, no one would want to know me. He's a balloon evangelist, and it really does bring him to tears.
Yeah, Sarah and I were both really fascinated by the gospel balloon contingent of this community, and we were interviewing him just as a gospel balloon artist, and he opened up about his story, how he really discovered God through the balloons, and how he believes that it was his gift in life to preach the gospel using balloons. And he teaches at classes, gospel balloon classes, and he does gospel routines. And there's a fair amount of people within the community who do gospel ballooning.
Anybody who's ever had a birthday party for a child, you know, knows, you know, when the balloon people come. But as we're learning, they just, you know, balloon people come into all sorts of places. We want to meet another balloon twister, James Smith. He's one of the few African-American balloon twisters, and they're sort of a subset within the group at the convention. He's known in his Atlanta neighborhood as Mr. Me and has become a real role model for kids with his balloons. Let's listen to a little of his story.
I wanted to find something to show the kids that everybody don't have to be a drug dealer to be successful.
You can make as good of money in a day as a dope dealer make in a day.
And you can lay down and go to sleep at night.
I can make the machine guns, I can make the Uzi type stuff, but I like to do the simple and cute stuff. I don't want to get into the guns and all of that. This is my diamond ring. Bling, bling. Can you see it?
We see James with kids, and they, you know, they're obviously getting his message. And it's a real message.
Yeah, I mean, he's someone who, similarly to Vera, recognized that the way they were living and the way they brought up was not how they wanted to be and raise their children. And luckily were able to find, you know, financial stability and other things through the balloons, and then also be able to give back, which is what James
did. Vera was a young teenager who living in a trailer park when her family fell on misfortune and started. She had a real talent for making balloon animals. And, you know, with the help of a neighbor, worked her way out of that trailer park.
Yeah, and she really is a very talented balloon twister, but more than that, she has drive like I've never seen anyone. I mean, she was so inspiring with her can-do attitude, and she had no role models. I mean, James is now a role model to kids in his neighborhood, but no one in her family ever went to college, and she just sort of knew that that's, you know, what she wanted to do.
I used to have dreams that I would die. And instead of my life flashing before my eyes, it was this despairing thought. How could I die if I haven't even lived? I haven't even done anything with my life yet. This really, really sucks. I think people like balloons so much because they like the potential. Here's this thing. It doesn't look like much, but you can make almost anything out of it.
We should give credit to Marvin Hardy, the godfather of balloon twisting from Provo, Utah, who started it all. But as you said, you had this passion as well, and I can't help but notice there's a lot of very colorful pieces of latex here on the table, along with the little balloon dog that everybody knows. It's sort of a French Fifi, you know, it's got the little poof on the end of the tail. Well, here's the thing. I have a fear of balloon twisting.
I once did also.
Yeah, right, because you're afraid it's going to blow up in your face. So as we go out here, Naomi Greenfield, again, the producer-director of Twisted, a balloonamentary. And by the way, we have much more about the film on our website, here-now.org. Can you show me how to make a balloon dog?
Sure, sure.
What's the trick?
I'm going to teach you the three-twist dog, which is the most simple. You sort of pinch 3 inches in.
Really pinch it? It's not going to blow up?
Yeah.
And twist. Pinch. It's twisting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. Now hold that a little bit with your head, and then just fold.
Fold. What if it's going to blow up?
No, you got space. I left you space on the end.
Fold.
A little closer.
Okay.
And then right where these connect, you'll make another twist.
All right. Okay. All right. And?
And then you're going to pull these out a little bit and turn them.
This is not going
to
work.
You got it. You also have to believe that you can do it.
Oh,
good,
there.
Good. Excellent.
I have made a dog.
Very well done.
My first balloon dog. Naomi, thanks.
Thank you.
And the real secret, don't blow it up fully. Leave about 3 inches at the tail. That's the trick. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashluck, Hitesh Hathi, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Chiggers is our engineer, our web producer, Ken George, our managing editor, Chris Ballman, senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young, recovering from my fear of balloons. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.